We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages and hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, you're here to hear Robert Bell tell his story. I've only been in the program for a little more than 2 years, but when Robert was one of the first people that I saw really working the program, he definitely has something that I wanted, and I hope he shares that with you tonight. Please welcome Robert.
My name is Robert Bell, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to go ahead and take this jacket off before I get into the self-revealing components of the story. And I hope after I say all that, that Tim still wants something I got. We'll see. But I want to thank Tim for asking me to do this. And if there's any problem with anything I say, please visit with him after the meeting. And if you like what I say, you're welcome to visit with me. But I'm glad to be able to come here and share a little bit about me. And there's a lot of things that I have to say, and I'm going to get into that in a minute. But I really love Alcoholics Anonymous because it gave me a way of life that I really did not have any idea about. And I'd sort of bounced in and out of AA, and then that magic happened, and I got sober. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I really believe that when we come here, we've got that common problem. It's something we can agree on. But I stayed here long enough to find out about that common solution. I certainly know that not only do I agree with it, but it's something that I'm willing to work on with everybody here, and we do it in a harmonious way. And, you know, we're here in Atlanta, and I grew up in Atlanta. And how many people actually grew up here in Atlanta? Man, look at that. That's a bunch. Who would have thought that? You really don't see that too much as I run into people. But I was born in 1955 down at Georgia Baptist Hospital, and of course now that's Atlanta Medical, and my parents were married. They took me home to an apartment on Piedmont Road. We shortly thereafter moved over into DeKalb County, and after that, when I was still young, moved over into the Chesthane Park area, and that's where I grew up. That was where my formative years were, and I had great educational opportunities. I had good religious training. I was taught right from wrong. My parents not only taught me, but they even demonstrated it to me, you know. So it wasn't because of broken home or things like that that I started drinking. I had all those types of things. And a couple of stories when I was young. And, you know, I read the stories in the book, and I sort of think about that. I listen to speaker tapes. But I really think it's important that I actually tell you what's going on in my life. When I was really young, when I was probably 4 or 5 years old, and this story was retold to me over and over, too. But I can remember my mom was out of town, and my dad and I were the only ones at home. I had a younger brother, and he was with my mom, and we were taking a nap. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I got up to get a glass of water or something like that and decided it'd be a good idea to hide from my dad. And he woke up and looked for me, and he couldn't find me, and he called for me. And then he got the neighbors. We had a creek in the backyard, and he had people out looking around the creek, and he was about to call the police. He came in the house, and he screamed one more time, and I finally came out from hiding. And I'll never forget, there was probably a good spanking involved and all sorts of things, but I can remember the message that I got, and the message I heard over and over was, Robert, when I call you, you need to come. When I ask you a question, you need to respond. You need to tell the truth. Honesty is the best policy. That's the kind of thing I can remember hearing growing up. Honesty is the best policy. And, of course, that's one of the principles we talk about here, and that was the kind of thing that, you know, I was brought up with from a very early age. And my dad was not an honest man. And my mother, you know, I never heard anything or saw anything that would say anything different to that. And yet, you know, by the time I was 10 years old, I can remember riding my bicycle up to that old Sears store that used to be in the middle of Buckhead, right at West Paces Fair. And those that have been around Atlanta for a while remember that being there. It's torn down now. And I can remember riding my bike in and going in and buying one album, you know, those big vinyl albums, and they'd stick it in that plastic bag. And as I left the store, I just would stick other albums in it and steal those things, you know? And I don't know that it was for lack of money. I mean, we weren't really affluent, but we certainly weren't poor. But it was sort of that kind of thing, just living on the edge. And I hung out with kids, and we did stuff like they'd be building a new house in the neighborhood, and we'd take the lumber to go build a tree house. And I just thought that was kid kind of stuff. But, you know, as I've grown up, I found out it's vandalism and theft and stuff like that. And yet I didn't see too much wrong with it. I thought that kind of stuff was okay. And that's sort of the way I grew up and had good examples, didn't always follow the role models. And yet something happened when I was 12 years old. My dad was out of town. I was at home with my mom and my brother. It's between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and the governor of Georgia had furloughed a bunch of prisoners. And didn't know that at the time. But nonetheless, my mother heard some rattling on one of the windows, and she went and flicked the lights on and off. And she heard more rattling. She had the foresight to call the police. And this guy went ahead and broke into our house. My mom shut herself into the bedroom with me and my brother. This guy pushed his way into the bedroom, and I'll never forget, it was dark. And this guy had on a red jacket, and the one thing I remember, he said, "You two guys shut up or I'll beat the hell out of you." And he grabbed my mother and was dragging her up to the front of the house. And my mother was saying, "You know, we've got money, we've got some Christmas gifts, and we have silver and stuff like that." And that wasn't what he was there for. She was convinced he was there to rape her. And about that time, though, the police showed up, seemingly to save the day. And, you know, they did save the day. They prevented any harm to my mother as far as rape or anything like that. But certainly the trauma was awful. But the thing that happened that night that was so dramatic is my brother and my mother and I left that home and went to a hotel, and we never returned to that house again. Police for fingerprinting and all that kind of stuff. And you know, as a young kid, I can remember that's the kind of thing that can make you mad, you know, that there was a lot of anger there. And I didn't realize how being mad and angry was going to impact my life. And the fear, you know, it was just the kind of thing, the life-changing event. Of course, my dad was mad as hell. I can remember him coming home and, you know, all sorts of stuff. But we never moved back to that house. And we stayed in an apartment for a while and moved back to another house. But that was one of those kind of things. It just sort of changed the whole tenor of things going on in the house. And, you know, within a couple of years, I can remember I was out with a friend, Rex. And, you know, I don't remember having this big void. I sort of hung out with kids and I sort of felt like I was a little bit different. I wore glasses and my hair was sort of this goofy red color. But I didn't really feel outwardly tons different. But I can remember when I was out with my friend, Rex, and he was 15 and I was 15. And we're out driving around Buckhead in his mom's car. And we still had that disregard for the laws, you know, but we drove up in front of the old high school, and I can remember the McClellan brothers were there, and they drove a Volkswagen van, and they lived up in North Sandy Springs, and they had a couple cases of beer, and they said, "Robert and Rex, do you guys care to join us to go out and drink some beer?" And we said, "You bet." You know, we jumped in the van. We wanted to be a part of those older guys, and they were the kind of guys that played in the band, and they dated women, and they had their own van, and they actually had driver's licenses to drive around with, you know, and so I can remember I drank, and I drank enough to where I sort of went into at least a blackout. I don't remember all that happened. I know I didn't get into bad trouble, and I might have gotten sick. But the very thing that makes me an alcoholic happened that first time. The very first time I drank, I lost the control of the amount of alcohol that I took. I drank till I got drunk. I did not plan on that, and I don't know why that happened, and yet that's what happened with me. Now, my friend Rex, I still see him these days, and he'll have a couple drinks, and he quits. When I drank that first time, I drank till I got drunk. And that's one of the key components, that phenomenon of craving the book talks about. But even more compelling than that is I knew I was going to do it again. And, you know, at age 15, it wasn't easy to just get alcohol all the time. But I know I was drinking when the opportunity came up. We'd steal it from our parents', you know, liquor cabinet or from a friend's house and things like that. So those periodic times. And, you know, as time went on, by the time I was 16, I can remember it was the weekend of the great raft race. And if you've been around Atlanta a long time, you can remember that. And I look around and the people who are here are smiling because they remember it. In fact, a few people had their eyes sort of rolling in the back of their heads. And it was that kind of day. It was a May afternoon. And what it was, if you weren't here in Atlanta, it was a time when a radio station and Budweiser had this, what they called a race, but really it's about 300,000 people would float down the Chattahoochee River. And they'd drink lots of beer, and it was a real big party. And it sort of started up on the north end, and it finished somewhere past River Bend. And River Bend was sort of the big party scene area. And I was with this friend of mine, Drew Doyle, and we were driving along in his TR6. And he asked me, he says, "Robert, do you want to smoke a joint?" As he was rolling this up. And I said, "Well, yeah, you bet. I'll try it." You know, the first time I had an opportunity to drink, I did that. The first time I had an opportunity to smoke pot, I did that. And I'm not going to get into a lot of drugs. A lot of times, though, people, when they get to this part of their story, they apologize for their drug use. And, you know, talking to alcoholics, I don't really see the need for that. I've had to apologize to my parents, and I apologize to school administrators and teachers, and, you know, the police got involved a few times in my teen years and my 20s, and the judges, and I've apologized a lot. But for a little intermittent drug use between my drunken binges, I really don't see the need to apologize here. And on top of that, you know, in Bill's story, he talks about using sedatives and mixing it with his gin and tapering off with morphine. And, you know, when I read that, I thought, that's the kind of doctor I need. One of these AA doctors will help me taper off with morphine, you know. That'll be perfect. But anyway, so I tried a little marijuana, and, you know, that was okay. But I really enjoyed the drinking. And a great thing happened, too, is they changed the drinking age to 18 when I was 17. And that made it a lot more accessible. And, you know, within another 6 months, this girl I was dating, her name was Sherry, she had this thing she wanted to do at her house. And she pulled out this mirror and she dumped this powder on it. And she had this ritual where she chopped it all up. She pulled out a dollar bill and she says, "If you snort this with me, Robert, I'll let you feel my boobs." Well, you know what happened then. I ended up doing drugs for about the next 20 years, along with the alcohol. And that's sort of the way it went. And I can tell you, you know, I had a few encounters at home, and I had a few encounters with the police. And it's pretty minor stuff, drunken disorderly. And I went off to college in North Carolina. I graduated in the normal time, and I went off to school, and it lasted a little longer than the typical 4 years. But up at school, I didn't run into the cops a whole lot. I ended up on the dean's list. But this was not for any academic achievement. This was for criminal problems. The police would come and take you back to the college campus, and they'd make you go see the dean. And that kind of thing was starting to happen with more frequency. I came back to Atlanta. I graduated, and I got involved in a business and was making money, and I was living sort of north of Buckhead, sort of between Buckhead and Sandy Springs. That's when the limelight was going in the Buckhead Saloon. I was really enjoying the nightlife, and it was a lot of fun, but I was drinking and driving all the time. And people that drink and drive enough, they end up getting caught. And I had the unfortunate occurrence of getting caught 3 times in about a 2-month period, and it wasn't good, you know. I mean, that would be miserable. They'd just lock you up. They would not even consider, you know, any mercy. And I can remember I got this attorney, and the attorney was helpful. He says, "Robert, whatever they ask you, just be quiet, and I'll be your spokesman here." But the judge was looking at the tickets. He saw my record, and I'd had a number of occurrences where I'd end up in jail for, you know, drunk disorder and all this. And he was looking at these 3 DUIs that need to be taken care of that day. And he said, "Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" And my thought was, no, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating that was the real problem. But he was right, and he pinpointed the idea. You know, he looked me in the eye, and he could see there was plenty of objective evidence that I had a problem with alcohol. Now, he didn't follow it with one of these things that they do these days. He said, "Why don't you try AA?" He didn't say that, but it was a point that I remembered. And, you know, I could continue with those kind of stories, but I do want to get around to the point of recovery. And about that time, though, my friends were getting married, and I thought, you know, maybe I should get married too. And I ran into a woman, and I got to know her, and I'm not married to her anymore, but this is a woman I fell in love with, and we were married for a number of years, and though we're divorced now, I'm pleased to say that she's remarried. But, you know, we fell in love, and she was an untreated Al-Anon, and I was an active alcoholic. And what that means is, of course, I'm thinking about me all the time, and an untreated Al-Anon is thinking about me too. So now I have 2 people thinking about me, and that's even better. Unfortunately, she went to Al-Anon and learned the nature of my disease, which I had not learned. And but we'd have those typical problems that you have, and I didn't understand what was going on. But I'd go out and say, "I'm going to stop, and I'll be home by 7:30, no later than 8 o'clock. I'm going to have a couple of beers with my friends, and it'd be this time of year," and the Braves game would come on. And next thing I know, the Braves game is going off, and I've had a lot more than a couple of beers, and I miss dinner, and I have that fight. And it's that fight that recurs over and over and over again. And I had no explanation for it. Did not know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And yet my wife was patient. She started going to Al-Anon. But what happened, too, is along that time we wanted to have children. In fact, I can remember I wanted to also prepare for having children. I can remember I had this friend of mine that sold insurance. He came to me and he gave me this form and it was all to fill out. And it had questions on it. It says, like, "Have you ever been charged with a felony?" "Well, no." "Have you ever been convicted of a felony?" "No." "Have you ever been to a mental institute?" "No." Little did I realize all that was going to come to pass too, see? But I bought that insurance. We wanted to have a child, but we couldn't have children. We ended up adopting, and in the process of the adoption, though, and trying to have children, the doctors thought there could be this one operation they could do for me which might increase the opportunity of us having children. So I let them do it. It includes surgery down in the abdomen, and they had to cut me open, and that's a painful thing. And you know, that type of pain requires medication. And I was in pain, in serious pain, and not only did I let the surgeon know, but I let my family doctor know, and I let the other doctors that I met know. And they could see the pain I was in, and they wanted to help. And it was kind of them, and they did. But the doctors also had a certain degree of moral concern about probably their medical license and my well-being, too, certainly. And so they stopped. They slowed down. They wouldn't give me those prescriptions. But I had noted that one friend of mine left his prescription pads conveniently in the office. And so I picked them up. And I had noted how they filled them out by, you know, making a Xerox copy of a few. And so I thought, you know, for the ease of the doctors and the pharmacists, I'll just fill these out and I won't have to bother them with them filling them out and things like that. And so I began doing that. And that started, it was probably like 1985, and it continued for 5 years. And during that time is when we adopted our son, Stuart. And we got a call on April 29th, 1987, that a little boy had been born down in Thomasville, and if we wanted to come pick him up, we could head down there, and we were certainly excited. And so we took off in our car and went down there. I'll never forget as I was driving down there that, you know, this might be a good time to stop drinking and popping pills and doing the stuff I'd been doing. I'd quit doing street drugs because I'd cleaned up my act, but of course, medicinal drugs was a different ball game. And so what I really thought then is, you know, maybe this is a good time to quit. But, you know, that thought simply went away with the clamors of the world. I had no fight against the first drink, no defense against that first drink. But I can remember that coming up. And, you know, as life went on, I kept writing those prescriptions. And like anything you do, like I said, if you drink and drive all the time, sooner or later you get caught. And these days, you know, if you write enough prescriptions, you'll get caught too. And these days, in fact, because of that internet that Al Gore invented, they have a much better way to keep up with it. And yet, you know, they just caught me because I was pretty much incompetent, and I got arrested. I could have gotten out on a first offender status, and I was offered the opportunity for treatment and all sorts of things, but I said, no, I can control it. But, you know, I couldn't control it, and before it was over, within 6 months, I'd committed crimes such that ultimately I got charged with, you know, robbery and assault and all those kinds of bad things that you really, I mean, I'm not even going to get into it all, but I just could not stay away from those drugstores. Because I need that to supplement me, you know, when I was drinking and when I was not drinking, for that matter. And that was the time when I had my first experience with AA. It was January 6, 1990. I had been to this outpatient treatment. They said, you got to go to AA. And they told me to meet this guy. And we met and we went to this place over in East Cobb. And I'll never forget, it was down in the church basement. And I walked down, there's a floor like this. Because I remember it was a linoleum floor and they had fold-up chairs. And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, what has become of my life? It was Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm at AA. It was miserable, really, and I have no idea what's going to happen. And, you know, I was going to a few AA meetings. I was going to this treatment stuff, mainly trying to do what my attorney said, because initially when he said we add up all these things, we're looking at a lot of years in jail. And then about April of that year, he said, if we do everything that we're supposed to, we can plea bargain such that we can get it down to just 2 years to serve in prison. And this did not sound like a real plea bargain to me, but nonetheless, that's what he told me. Now, September rolled around. I did some, you know, pleading with a variety of people, including some of the victims, and they wrote some letters. And I did not have to go to prison, thank God, but I was put on intensive probation and long-term probation and was told that I had to keep going to AA. And I'd like to say that, you know, I came to AA, got a sponsor, and I've been sober ever since. But that's not what happened. I just was not ready to stop. The third tradition says the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. The long form says it's for all who suffer from alcoholism, which was me, and want to recover, which was not me. And so somehow I stayed out of jail, and even though I had to go in for tests, and I'm not going to tell you how I got by, but nonetheless I got by, and just to roll to that last day, I had gotten off of probation, I was not under the scrutiny of anybody, you know, I had arrived. And I can remember it was April of 2001, and we went on spring break, and I went with my wife and my son, and we went down and visited friends, had a great time down there, and got back on a Thursday night. And I'd been away from all my friends, and I thought I'd go out and have a couple beers, and then the usual thing happened. I ended up getting really drunk, and I was supposed to go to work the next morning. And so I got up, and I did not feel good, and I went on into work, and fortunately I had some of those goofballs I'd been taking. I took a handful of them at work. And, you know, I did not count the number I took, and I took way too many, and I got that feeling of getting woozy, and I tried to make it back to my office, and people saw me as I sort of staggering, and I collapsed. And I forgot to tell you, at this point, I was working at a church in a recreation center, and it always impresses church officials when you overdose at work. They think maybe we should check our employment questionnaire. We might have missed something here. But anyway, I keeled over, and I had this vague memory of all those things you learn in CPR. Somebody saying, "You, call 911, and they're trying to make sure I'm breathing, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And this wasn't the first time this had happened to me, but thank God it was the last time. And the ambulance came. They took me down to Piedmont, and you know, you come to in the hospital, and it's always sort of a scary thing because you come to and you're looking up at bright lights, and there's people around you, and they're poking you and prying you, and they're saying, "Are you okay? Can you breathe deep?" And they're asking your name. Do you know what the date is? Do you know who the president is? They're trying to see what's going on, see if you know what's up. And I sort of came out of it relatively well. And of course, the bad thing is when you get down there, you ain't got your car. They won't let you just run out, jump in your car, and drive home. And so I had to call home and ask my wife if she had come get me. And I'll never forget what she said. She says, "Robert, is there any hope?" That was an excellent question. Is there any hope? But I'm a guy that the glass is always half full, you know. I said, "Yeah, you bet." And I don't know what I had hope in. But I'm the kind of guy that always has a little bit of hope. And I'll never forget the doctor. They always fill out this form when you leave, those discharge papers, and they ask you a bunch of questions. And he asked, "What was going on? You took those pills. How many did you take?" And I said, "Well, I just took a handful." And he said, "Weren't you afraid of overdosing?" And I said, "No, I'm afraid of the dreaded underdose, to tell you the truth, you know." And that's the way I drink, and that's the way I do everything, you know. I worry about not getting enough, and that's the way it was. And of course, my wife had been patient. She had been patient for about 9 years now while I was floundering around AA. She had certainly been to Al-Anon, and she teamed up with my boss. And I'll never forget, they said something to the effect of, "Robert, you're not doing yourself any good. You really need to get some help here." And by this time, I was sort of feeling that inside feeling that you get when I think you're ready to get sober. And it's not the outside circumstance anymore. It's not the felonies. It's really not the medical condition. It's just you've lost your self-respect. I couldn't stand myself anymore in the way that I treat my family and the people around me. And I just more or less can remember saying, "Whatever, you know, just if you can come up with a plan, it's got to be better than the one I got." So my wife said, "Well, you need help, and you aren't going to get it from here anymore." And she was really kind, and she packed a suitcase for me. And she put it out in the car and took me off. And I went to this place out in East Georgia called Penfield. And I was there about 2 days. And they noticed I was starting to shake. And they said, "Robert, have you detoxed?" I said, "What do you mean?" "No, I came straight here." And so they said, "Well, you're sick. We got to get you off." They asked how much I've been drinking. I've been drinking way too much, obviously, and doing lots of other things. And so they took me up to the Athens detox because it was the closest. And they immediately got me into care. I can remember the first day I'd been there, they started checking my insurance cards, and they found out that I really should have been sent to Peachford. And I'm thinking, oh gosh, I'm starting to get that upper GI disorder that comes when you're in detox and you can't hold stuff down. And it was rather messy, and they said, "We have got to put you on this gurney, and we're transporting you tonight as soon as the traffic dies down from Athens down to Peachford." So I said, "Okay." And so they strapped me on there, and, you know, they got you tied down. They have your hands tied down and your feet tied down. And then they strap you down real tight so that you can be in that ambulance. And I'm thinking, so this are some of the joys of recovery, you know, as I'm riding down the highway between Athens and Atlanta. And, you know, I got to the Peachford Mental Institute, and at Peachford, they offer a lot of great things. They offer recreation therapy. and art therapy and music therapy. And these are wonderful things. And I'm sure it helps lots of people, but it is not the appropriate therapy for alcoholism. And yet, you know, I enjoyed that stuff and was there for about 17 days. And it's interesting. Right now, I actually do work trying to get people out of the mental institute. And I work with people with developmental disabilities and with mental health problems. And every now and then, I do some research. And I happened to find something on the internet that I thought was just hilarious. I only found it a couple weeks ago. But I've got to read it to you. And this is for those people who have not overcome the obsession to drink. And what its title is, How to Survive in a Mental Institute. They've got 7 points, and I'll go through them real quick because I'll otherwise run out of time. But here's the first one. Make one or more friends. That's a good idea because by the time you get to a mental institute, you have developed a certain level of sociopathy that you've chased all your friends away. The second one, this is a good one. If you don't smoke, start. And get a pack for the staff to hold. And if you do, make sure you have a pack that the staff will hold. 3, stay outside of your room in the hall or the day room. 4, attend groups and participate. 5, do something that looks active but quiet. And these last two are key. 6, ignore people screaming and flailing about. And 7, do not fight with the workers. Nod and smile. Well, I was one of the nodders and smilers, but fortunately, there were people there who were bringing in AA meetings, and they were bringing it right out of the book, and I'm grateful that they did that. And one of my last days there, it might have been the next last day, this guy that worked for Peachford, he came to me and he said, you know, we're getting ready to discharge you. You've fulfilled your treatment, and I think you're planning to go back for Penfield. And I said, I fulfilled my treatment. How can you tell? He said, your insurance money's run out. And that's sort of the way it works. And anyway, he said, but you've been to AA, hadn't you? And I said, well, yeah. He said, have you taken the steps? I said, no. I mean, I knew I hadn't taken the steps. I'd come in late, leave early, all that stuff. And he said, well, did you have a sponsor? And I said, yeah, but not really. He said, so you didn't really do any work? And I said, no. And he said, well, what did Bill find? He said, did you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yeah, I've read it at least twice. And he said, well, do you remember what Bill finally did? And I could not put together what he was really asking me. He said, Bill tried to help other alcoholics. At the beginning, he was helping people in the Institute. He said he would go there and tell them what he was doing to get better and tell them that they had to do the same thing and pass it on to others. And ultimately, he found Dr. Bob. And he asked me this question before he sent me back to the day room so I could nod and smile and said, do you think AA can work for you? Do you think AA can work for you? For an alcoholic of my type, I think that's the only thing that will work for me. Anyway, they packed me up, sent me back off to Penfield. Penfield kept me for 6 weeks. They thought it wasn't long enough treatment, so they sent me off to another halfway house. And, you know, I called my wife thinking that she might be ready for me to come home. She said, no, those people at Al-Anon think you ought to stay away as long as you can. And she was right. Because while I was at this halfway house, at Mar, they told me I had to do a couple things. And one was go to AA, and another was get a sponsor, and they suggested I even take the steps. And so I can remember I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to Peachtree Corners, and I found this man, Pat Moore, and he was walking around. He carried these two books here. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he asked me a couple questions. 1, do you think you're an alcoholic? Don't even remember what I said. He said, can you stop on your own? And I know what I said then. I said, no, because I had a 30-year history of not being able to. And he said, are you willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcohol? And I said, yeah, you bet. You know, got to impress that sponsor from the get-go. So I told him that, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, I want you to meet me here this Friday. I said, okay, I'll see you here Friday at 8. He said, no, I want you here at 7. And he said, why? He said, because we're going to help set up. We got to put up chairs. We got to make coffee. We got to put out literature. And he showed me some of the service things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a great thing. He says, well, on top of that, we're going to start reading the book, and I want you to read the doctor's opinion. I said, okay, well, I'll read the doctor's opinion. And my thought was, as I was going to come in, we'd get all that stuff set up, and then we'd have this lively discussion, him and me, on what the doctor's opinion meant. And I sort of led into it that way, and he says, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I said, no, and I talked a little more, and he says, you know, there's all sorts of things that we need to do before we get here. And I tried to explain a little more, and he had a one-word explanation that clarified everything for me. He says, Robert, shut up. And that seemed to work because I knew he was being clear with me. And what he did, he took me to the front cover of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, really, that blank page is what you know, and we're going to move through. And when we got to the title page, it said, how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism? thousands, broad-based, men and women inclusive, recovered to regain our spiritual, mental, and physical health from alcoholism, that it's a disease that we can recover from. And, you know, I was sort of amazed because I'd never had anyone approach me like that. And we went through the steps and briefly, you know, we took a look at the doctor's opinion, found out that I'm mentally and bodily different, that I have that phenomenon of craving, that once I start drinking, I drink till I get drunk and I can't stop. Worse than that, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in my mind, that I've got a strange mental thought process that takes me back to the drink, and it did for 30 years. I had to believe that something could help. I believe my sponsor was sober, and I had to believe that if it could work for him, it could work for me. And he told me that the only sanity I may regain is to overcome the insanity of the first drink, like Bill had on Armistice Day. He said, if I regain that sanity, it'd be a great gift. And he pointed to all sorts of places in the book when it brought up sanity, and it had to do with the first drink. Never understood that. You know, we got to page 63, did the third step prayer, got on our knees and took that prayer. And immediately, that night, we began the fourth step. And I said, I don't know that I've got that many resentments. And he says, oh, Robert, it's your dad. And he told me the reasons. It's like, Mom, I mean, he could list seven or eight things immediately because he'd been listening to me every day on the phone when I'd call up and sort of go through my stuff. He knew who I was mad at. And so he helped me take the fourth step by doing that multi-column thing. But more important than the stuff I wrote was the stuff we did after the third column, when I started praying for the people I was mad at. That's where the change came. When it came time for the fifth step, where it says we're trying to get a new relationship with our Creator, he pointed out that we've got a new relationship with our Creator because we've been praying for people that we hate. And that was a big change for me because I wanted to get even. You know, I didn't want to pray for them. And I'd taken a look at potentially where was I to blame and where were my character defects. In the process of doing the fifth step, which I did with my sponsor, I got clear with that. And I took an hour to take a look at it. We went right then to the sixth and seventh step, and I started asking for help from God with those character defects. You know, step eight, I love what it says, but I was in here, and it wasn't too long ago, and a brand new person was sitting on the front row, and she was reading the steps. And it says, made a list of all person who had harmed us. And I thought, that's the way I want to do the eighth step, is I want to make a list of all them people. But that's not what we did, is actually to do the eighth step. He gave me the list, because the book says we made it when we took inventory. And he said, this is a great starting place for us to do our amends. And we read how to do it. And as soon as I'd made a couple of amends, he went ahead and got me onto the tenth step, where we keep watching for the things. We keep doing inventory, and we try and keep our plate clean. And, you know, step 11, he had me doing those things, what we do when we retire at night, what we do when we get up. And when we got to page 88, which is the end of the 11th step, he looked at me and said, you know, Robert, you've done everything that Alcoholics Anonymous asked you to do, and it's time for you to start praying for someone that you can help. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it's talking about 1 through 11, we carry this message to other alcoholics, and I want you to start praying for that. And, you know, within about 6 weeks, I sponsored someone. And you know, here tonight, there's a guy that I sponsored virtually as long as I've been sober, and a guy that I sponsored less than a week, and a bunch of guys in between. And I'm really grateful that my sponsor got me on that path early, and that's really, I believe, what saved my life. And, you know, in that first year, I still, you know, just straightened out the problems that I'd created at home. My dad had lived with me for a number of years, and he was in his late 80s, and he had to check in the hospital, and he had this infection going on, and they couldn't seem to straighten it out. It got caught in his pacemaker, and about 3 or 4 days before he died, I can remember I was sitting in his hotel room. It was a Saturday morning. It was real early, and he looked at me in the eye, and he says, you know, Robert, there comes a time in every man's life when he's ready to meet his maker. He said, I made peace with God, and I made peace with my fellow man. Yeah, that sounds like something we'd say here in AA. And he never went to an AA meeting, but I think that was the very thing he was trying to tell me when I was a little boy and wouldn't come to him, that honesty was the best policy, that there's a way of life that we can have, a design for living that you can have peace and fulfillment. He was ready to meet his maker. I was not ready for him to meet his maker, but he was ready, and that was the key thing. You know, 2 days later he died, and I was there with my wife and my son and my brother and his wife, and we were able to say prayers that he would appreciate and hold his hand as he breathed his last. And you know, a couple days later, we did his funeral, and he had lived with us, so my former wife did a part of the funeral, and I did the sort of family eulogy, because I could talk about fishing and stuff with the other nephews, and talk to his brother and sister about things, and knew some of his business friends, and all that kind of stuff. My son came up and read the 23rd Psalm, and you know, I would have never believed it, But inside of a year, we were reading the 23rd Psalm at my son's funeral. And what happened was I woke up on July 24th. It's July 24th, 2002. I'd been sober less than 2 years. And I'd gotten up. I'd gotten on my knees and asked God to help me stay sober, to relieve me of the obsession. I did the third step prayer. My wife went out to jog. She came in and said, get Stuart up to go to soccer camp. So I did. Last thing he had said to me the night before was, good night, Dad. Make sure my clothes were ready. And as I went downstairs and I rounded the corner down to the basement, I looked ahead and I saw a sight that I'll never forget. And my son had hung himself. And his legs were down to the ground. His knees were nearly on the ground. And we think he's playing the choking game, which there had been some stuff we saw on the computer trying to get an asphyxiation high. But whether he did it on purpose because he wanted to end his life or whether it was an accident, it really doesn't matter. I walked over and held him, and, you know, he was cold. There was no CPR to be done and no first aid. And I'm told that as I ran up the stairs, I let out a yell, and I had to tell my wife what had happened. And I asked her to call 911. I called my sponsor. I called Pat, and Pat came over, and I'll never forget. He walked in, and just like the first time I saw him, it seems like every time that I had something to talk to him about how to help the next new guy. He walked in, he had these two books with him. And there was a couple people that were starting to show up, and he sat down. I remember we sat at our table, and he said, get your big book. And I said, okay. And he said, we're going to do something we've done before. And I don't know how sponsors know to do this. They just seem to know the right thing to say. And he said, open it up to page 63. And I did, and there was a family friend who was a pastor, and he didn't know it, so we got him a book, but we prayed it together. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help, of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. And I think God honored that prayer. You know, I had talked with a couple alcoholics that morning, asked God to help me stay sober and take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to God's help, His power, and His love. And God helped me that day. I stayed sober that day. But the real miracle is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. The people from Peachtree Corner showed up. Friends that I'd gotten sober with at Mar showed up. And they loved me, and they loved my family, and they loved people that showed up. And it's funny, there was some people from church there, and there was people from church who had found God through their way. And they found alcoholics and crack addicts that had found God in the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we bonded. And, you know, Charles Dickens writes a book, and he says, and it starts off, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. You can understand certainly why this was the worst of times. But when I look back on this, it was the best of times because I saw the power of God's love through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous impacting my life in a way that I will never forget. And a lot of times you hear people sort of diminish the importance of the fellowship. They'll say, you got to get the program, you got to get... And believe me, people say I'm sort of that big book thumper kind of guy, and I believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will never minimize the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where my friends are. That's where the people that love me are, and that's where I can find people to love and people to help. You know, I stayed sober that day, and a variety of things went on that I can't really explain. People at Alcoholics Anonymous had faced that very same kind of tragedy. I'll never forget. There was a guy that was going to that Monday Peachtree Corners meeting, and I just knew Bob M. from doing that beginners meeting. But, you know, he came to see me within a week, and Bob just died in the last month. And he let me know of his losses, the things that he did to stay sober. And he said, you know, I made a commitment, a two-year commitment, to keep going to these same meetings when my wife was killed in a car accident. Very same ones. And he said, I don't know if it'll work for you, but it sure worked for me. And Bob impacted my life dramatically, and a lot of people in AA impacted my life dramatically. You know, I knew that I needed help, and the book talks about on page 133 that sometimes we need the help of doctors and other capable people that can give us that outside help we need. And I went out and I found this group of people that had had that same kind of problem. They had had a death by suicide. It's called Survivors of Suicide. And interestingly, Bill S. from Mount Vernon helped get that group going, gave them some insights, what Alcoholics Anonymous does. But this group meets, and it's sort of peer-led. And I went in there, and I just sort of mumble about what happened. I was absolutely miserable. you know, all I could think about was my son had died in that vision, and it was the only thing I could think about. I drive past a high school, and I think, well, that's where Stuart should have been going to school. You might say I was obsessed. And yet I had to believe that maybe God could do something here, that maybe God could restore me to sanity. The insane thing would be I'd be obsessed with that for the rest of my life, that it would destroy my life. And it does destroy some people's lives, believe me. But I decided I'd go to that group, and I'd get some counseling, I'd read some books. And I'll never forget, after about a year of doing that, one of the ladies that runs the group says, you know, this is a peer-led thing, and you seem to be doing better. We think you should maybe do some training so you can help the next people coming in. And I thought, well, I'm not doing that much better, believe me. But she seemed to think so, and I think her objective appearance, just like in AA, your objective appearance of what's going on with me is a lot better than what I think is going on with me. And so I did that, and I got involved in helping people who face that tragic situation when a loved one takes their life. And what I found is the steps apply to that just as well as anything else. That, you know, I've got a problem. And the problem was that my son did something I was powerless over, and it certainly made my life unmanageable. I had to believe that maybe God could do something about it, and I had to make a decision. I needed some kind of program of action. And it wasn't as clear-cut laid out as it is in the big book. You know, it says we've got precise things to do. We've got a clear-cut set of directions. But there was things that I could do to get better. I'll never forget this lady. I asked her, I said, you know, Iris, why is it that some people seem to get better than others? And she said this, and I believe it's true in that group, and I believe it's true in Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, Robert, people seem to get just about as well as they want to get. And I think that's true. And you know, for me, how I get better in Alcoholics Anonymous is I get involved. When I get away from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I find that, you know, I don't seem to do as well. And, you know, a lot of things have occurred since then. I mentioned my brother. In the next year, he was a drinker just like me. He was not a hard drinker. He had given sufficient reason he would not stop. And he drank himself into the hospital October 1st of 2003, and he died on October 22nd of cirrhosis of the liver. And I went up to see him every day. I drove up to Rome to see him. And, you know, I have no regrets because I did everything that I could to be a friend, to let him know what had occurred to me. And when I look at these kind of things, you think, gosh almighty, because most people that don't know all this stuff, they probably don't see me as a person who's faced these kind of challenges. But, you know, I've had great things happen since I got sober, too. Though I got divorced after the death of my son, I mean, that is the kind of thing that can really cause havoc in a marriage. I have remarried, and my wife is here. She's the well-dressed lady on the front row, not to diminish Tammy's dress or looks. But Carrie and I got married a couple years ago. She said, I'm going to dress up tonight. And all that told me is evidently I don't take her out enough such that we get dressed up if she's getting dressed up to come to an AA meeting. But her birthday is Friday, so I guess I get to make a quick amends there, a four-day turnaround, which is pretty good. And other good things. You know, I mentioned I've been able to keep stable employment since I got sober. I mean, it took me a while to get the first job. And, you know, this last job I got, I actually worked with the state. And I'll never forget, I filled out all the paperwork. I went in, did a great interview. I had to call them and say, by the way, I'm a convicted felon. And she says, well, I don't know what that means, but talk with Human Resources. So I talked with Human Resources, and they said, well, have you made all your restitution? I said, yeah. Are you still on probation? I said, no. She said, can you give me documentation? I said, yeah. She said, well, you're hired. And I said, huh. I wonder how many convicted felons work for the state of Georgia is what I wonder, you know. I'm going to close with one thing out of the 12 and 12. And I'm a big believer in the big book, but I can remember coming in, and early on people said, buy the big book and buy the 12 and 12 and read them both and reread them. And I believe the message of the big book is our basic text. But it also says in the front of the 12 and 12 that it enhances our understanding through the various articles on the step. And in chapter 12, it says, furthermore, how can we come to terms with seeming failure or success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable, satisfactions when the brighter, more glittering achievements are denied us? The AA answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep on trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, then they can become the fact of life for many more. And I certainly believe that's the case, that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're willing to admit utter defeat, and turn your life over to somebody. I mean, really anybody will do a better job with my life than me. Just anybody that's a sober member of AA, that you've got the great chance of getting sober and staying sober. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I found AA, and I love everything about AA. I do men's workshops. I go to the roundups. I try and do as many meetings as I can. I love everything. I love the grapevine. I always like to make fun of the grapevine. Recently, they started sending it out. Do people here get the grapevine? Anyone in here? Few people, you know. But they send it out, and you don't have to worry about getting AA literature. They send this nice, black, plain wrapper, and your neighbors think it's porn, you know. So you ain't got to worry. But I love everything about AA. Well, I think that's what they think. Anyway, I love everything about AA. AA has changed my life, and it is where I really find joy and fulfillment. There's nothing I'd rather do than spend time with other alcoholics and help them try and find the same joy and fulfillment that I've found. So my hope is if you're an alcoholic of my type, that you'll come here, that you'll ask for help, and that you'll take the 12 steps, and that too can be found for you. God bless. Thank you.